That wasn't much of a bang. There's a big bang. All right. I call the House Energy Committee meeting to order. Today is Tuesday, March 31st at 1:08 p.m. Members present are Representative Mia Costello, Representative Chuck Kopp, Co-Chair Representative Holland, and myself, Donna Mears. I'd also like to recognize Representative Zach Fields in the audience today. We have a quorum to do business. As a reminder, please silence your cell phones. Our staff... Also, as a reminder, staff and members of the audience, please don't approach the table. If you need to pass a note to members, please get the attention of my committee aide, Griffin Plush, up front. And I'd also like to thank Tim Truer with Representative Holland's office. We have helping us out today, Recording Secretary Andrew Magnuson and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO. On today's agenda, we have a presentation on Chugach Electric Association's hydroelectric program, as well as a committee substitute for House Bill 164, the annual net metering bill from the governor. So we're going to start off with hydro. So we'd like to invite Arthur Miller, CEO from Chugach Electric, Trish Baker, manager of government and business affairs, and Dustin Hires, VP of corporate programs. Please update us on your new hydroelectric program. Put yourself on the record and then please begin.
Very good. Well, good afternoon. My name is Trish Baker. I am the senior manager for government affairs at Chugach Electric. Thank you so much for inviting us here today. It's our pleasure to explain to you our hydro program, and which will bring develop Alaska resources for electric generation. And we're pretty excited about that. In U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski's remarks earlier today, she talked about having reason to be optimistic, and we agree. And we were also very pleased to hear her reporting on, at the federal level, the streamlining of the permitting process for hydroelectric projects. So with me today, as you had said, is our CEO, Arthur Miller, who will speak to you about Chugach Electric's decarbonization program, and our VP of corporate programs, Dustin Hires, who will specifically speak to you about the hydro program.
Well, members of the committee and co-chairs, I want to thank you for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. We really appreciate it. This is something that's very near and dear to Chugach, and actually a very timely topic when we look at our gas supply situation. Let me first back up a little bit. Our purpose here is to provide an update on our renewable generation portfolio, specifically with respect to hydroelectric projects. Hydroelectric projects for Chugach Electric are really meant to strengthen our generation portfolio, diversify our generation portfolio, and really position us for generation strength over the long term. It also helps us meet our long-term decarbonization goals. This afternoon, I do want to talk a little bit, and we'll go into further detail on this, but from an overall program perspective, we initiated the effort to look at hydro projects several years ago and really started out with over 150 potential locations in South Central Alaska. And through our work efforts, we have narrowed that down to four projects, the Caribou Creek project, the Canyon Creek project, Boulder Creek project, and Godwin Creek project. In total represents just a little bit over 50 megawatts of generation capacity. I do want to emphasize that no final decision has been made. What we are doing now is we are evaluating and undertaking significant studies associated with each of these projects. This afternoon, I'll start out by providing a high-level overview of our generation mix, and then by looking at our generation mix, how does this fit into our long-term strategic alignment from an organizational perspective, highlighting our decarbonization goals and the roadmap by what types of technologies that we look at to get there. On top of that, then, I'll then turn it over to Mr. Hires, who will talk about specifically the site selection process, the sites that we have identified for further investigation and do a deeper dive on each one of those sites and then look at the status of the overall program and stakeholder engagement, and then finally the FERC preliminary permit and the permit timeline that we expect to be operating under. Chugach Electric is approximately 80% in round numbers reliant on natural gas generation. That's a significant reliance on a single fuel source. We are approximately 20% renewables. These numbers change on an annual basis. It really depends on, in any given year, how much hydro or water we have available, hydrothermal coordination conditions, and so forth. What's I do want to highlight here is that just under 20% in this given year that these numbers represent was from hydro generation. Hydro generation is really a unique renewable resource. It's extremely long-lived assets. We're looking at assets that are over 100 years. In addition, it is the lowest priced, lowest cost generation in the Rail Belt. On what makes up Chugach's hydropower are 56% contractual arrangement with the Alaska Energy Authority with respect to the Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. We also own and operate the Cooper Lake Hydroelectric Project, and then we jointly own the Klutna Project with Matanuska Electric Association and the Municipality of Anchorage. By far, the cost of these projects is significantly lower than even the most efficient thermal generation that we have on our system. Our most efficient generation from the South Central Power Project or in from our Sullivan Power Plant is roughly 10 to 12 cents all-in cost. That includes fuel and fixed costs and variable O&M. But we're looking at hydro less than half that on an all-in cost basis. And the hydro project, as I said, not only are they long-lived assets, it provides price stability over the long term. The cost of Bradley Lake has not changed very much from it was when it was its commercial operation in 1991. Very stable pricing. It also allows us to regulate. With stored hydro, we can regulate intermittent renewable resources on our system, which is another tremendous benefit. And stored hydro also allows us to provide dispatch capabilities. If we need additional generation, we can count on that generation to meet our load requirements. It's also local sourced. We're not relying on exogenous factors, if you will, from the overall marketplace that we're seeing right now with fuel prices. So we absolutely embrace hydroelectric projects. We've seen a lot of the benefits, certainly in Southeast. We've seen a lot of the benefits with the three projects that Chugach is involved with. This really lays the foundation on where we're going as we look to the future. From a strategic priority area, the Chugach Board of Directors has established decarbonization goals, and that really is reduction in carbon. And our goal is to reduce our carbon intensity by at least 35% by 2030 and at least 50% by 2040 without a negative material impact on electric rates and reliability. Those criteria really are critical. And we look to those and we put a significant reliance on the cost impact to our members. Importantly, we regularly assess and we adjust our decarbonization strategies while balancing our interest with reliability and affordability. No question, the electric utility industry is under significant change. This presents tremendous opportunities for utilities that are proactive and progressive. As we look in this context, what we have done over the last 13 years, 14 years, and our efforts to reduce our carbon intensity, really a multitude of factors. It's not just adding renewable generation. It's also adding more efficient generation. In 2013, we put in commercial operation the South Central Power Project, which resulted in significant efficiency gains to our generation fleet MLNP at the time in 2017 put in plant 2A at the Sullivan Power Plant, again, resulting in significant efficiencies. In fact, those two generation units are the most efficient thermal generation units, not only on Chugach's system, but on the rail belt. But it's also working with other utilities. Chugach and Matanuska Electric Association with economic dispatch and power pooling. We're seeing benefits of that and lower fuel usage. We're also seeing benefits with the joint ownership of the battery energy storage system that's owned 75% by Chugach, 25% by Matanuska Electric. That results in fuel savings as well, where we can more optimize by operating the system in a more optimal manner. And those we translate into lower reliance on fuel, lower carbon impacts. In addition to that, we have the Fire Island Wind Project that was put in place. And we also, and you'll see really a downward overall trend in our carbon intensity. And that's really what we're focused on to continue making significant progress in this area. We're really taking a multifaceted approach on our efforts to decarbonize. We are really agnostic as far as technology, really what technology works. And we have not updated, we don't have final numbers for 2025 yet on our carbon intensity, but we are, in the last several years, we put in solar at our power plants at SPP and Sullivan, and a solar project that, actually the largest rooftop solar was put in our new operations building, and that was in operation earlier this year. That offsets directly fuel use that we need, would otherwise use for station service. So it results in a direct one-to-one benefit for the organization. Now, these are small steps. I'm not going to say that these are real meaningful, big impacts, but every bit helps. And we're taking opportunity to look, whether it's small or medium size, we certainly embrace that. And we don't want to throw those out as options. In addition to that, we did put in the first community solar project that was in commercial operation last year, and that's going well. We also, on the decarbonization front, on this, on really the customer side, I'll use it that way, but from a station service perspective, we put in a fuel cell. I'm sorry, not a fuel cell, a heat pump on one of our buildings adjacent to our area, our headquarters building. And that really is going to reduce, from a carbon perspective, reduce our footprint. Also, we have a new operations building that's going to be constructed this summer that also will have a heat pump installed at that location. So we're looking at this on a multifaceted basis. And as I look at...
Before you head on, I'd like to welcome Representative Edgman and Representative Ruffridge to the committee, about 1:20. And back on the last slide, so it says it's a decarbonization goal, but a carbon reduction goal, but there's other goals it looks like you're meeting in there. I just wrote a few things, a diversity of sources goal, a flexibility goal, stability and reliability. So, I mean, that's just one thing that you're hitting. Carbon reduction is just one thing that you're hitting with this suite of changes and growth and power options and balancing.
Representative Co-Chair, Mayors, yes, that is exactly right. We're really looking at this on a holistic basis. And that's why our goal is decarbonization, because that embraces energy efficiency. It embraces other technologies that we can adopt and support in our efforts to reduce carbon. And in that context, when we look at the roadmap that we are following, it's not just renewables. It's also grid development. We recognize that we need to have additional transmission infrastructure investment made. In fact, we've been working and continue to make significant positive progress on the upgraded transmission line from Anchorage to the Cooper Landing area, and then working collectively with the Alaska Energy Authority and other rebel utilities, upgrading the line from Cooper Landing to Sterling and Solvatna. And that really is critical. And I think we're going to see additional efforts in those areas by working together from that perspective. But we are taking a very broad perspective on this. also is the adoption of technology that's going to allow us to operate the system in a more efficient manner. I mean, I think we know where technology is going, and certainly in the industry, in the electric power industry, significant interest and advancements in that area. That's going to continue to grow as we go through time, especially with microgrids. We have been working with the Port of Alaska on a microgrid project over there, and that has been going very well. But on this slide also, we do have beneficial electrification, really more on the customer side, because we do support the adoption of electric vehicles. In fact, we have a fairly robust battery storage charging program, battery charging program that we're in the process of putting in place with level three chargers located on the Kenai Peninsula and Girdwood area, and then also in South Anchorage. We also support, as I mentioned earlier, heat pump technology, battery operated tools and equipment, and that trajectory really is going to continue to increase through time. So there's a tremendous amount of opportunities. What we really want to do is make sure that we can adopt these technologies and really increase the utilization of our electric system. That really is the name of the game in the electric power industry, is to maximize the use of assets. And these other technologies that are happening on the customer side is going to help us do that, but we have to have the right technology to be able to manage those processes. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Hires to talk specifically about our hydro program and the individual locations that were under study.
Good afternoon, Dustin Hires to the chairs. Thank you very much for having us. As the lead on the decarbonization program for Chugach, what I'd like to do is walk you through a little bit of the nuts and bolts of how we got to where we are with our hydro program. Specifically starting with site selection, just at a high level, we're approaching this as a programmatic funnel, if you will. There's a huge intake process as far as casting a wide net, taking it into a screening process. That takes us into an initial approval where we approach the executive staff and the board and talk about what direction we're going. Then we get into our due diligence and feasibility, which is where we are now. And we get into project approvals and those kind of requests more toward the end of the year after feasibility has been determined. So that's the high level on site selection. The thing I'd like to start with is saying, yes, it was about 158 sites. That is nowhere near the number of sites that are developable for hydro in the state. Those are just the ones in our region that we chose to focus on that we thought might be the most developable for us. There's an old joke, you probably heard it. There's no hydro in the state that has not been studied three times over. So if you have that list, this is the list we started with, and we started narrowing down from there. The things that our team, which is McMillan, they've done a lot of work in the state and done a lot of work with us on Cooper Lake, for instance, especially during the 50-year relicense that we got for that project. They walk through this process and say, well, we're going to take a look at what we can observe from a desktop, what we can estimate, and what we can calculate. So roughly talking, we're looking at the physical attributes. In other words, where is it? How far is it from the road? How far is it from transmission? Things like that. And then we have a little bit of a cutoff. We estimate what we're going to get out of it. And then you start getting into at least a high level on the costs, because you got to start somewhere. We have to establish some sort of screening criteria that says these are the projects that we want to sort down to and then sort and then prioritize. The screening criteria itself, you're looking at an exclusion of projects that were in the north, generally in the Fairbanks area, Denali National Park area. Of course, we're not going to get into that. Specific capital cost. $12,000 per kilowatt is typically pretty high. If you look at the development of hydro, for instance, in the lower 48, that seemed to be a good inflection point in the number of projects that we had, where the projects after that started jumping up quite a bit, almost double. So that gave us a subset of projects to move forward with as far as consideration. One of the things that that we specifically are concerned about is fish. And all of the issues related to fisheries, fish habitat, we know this is a huge issue for hydro and for hydro development. So one of the things that we took initially as a step is to say, We are looking for resources, sites where we do not have to put a dam in an anadromous reach. That's where the fish live. It doesn't mean that we wouldn't put a dam further upstream, which might cause downstream flow changes. I just want to be totally transparent about that. It's these sorts of things that we have to figure out downstream of this during the due diligence period. As far as the best energy production, of course, once you get that initial screening, you got to start stacking them up and saying which ones do we think would be the best producers. Now, after we started asking around, after we started talking to the agencies, after we started talking to the tribes, we came up with a few more things. They came up and said, let's make it clear. It's going to be very problematic for them to access sites that are in a wilderness area, in a designated wild or scenic river. The interbasin transfers, this relates to specifically one of the projects that we looked at where there's a lake higher and a lake lower. They don't want water transferring between those because they have different characteristics. So they said, please don't do that. And of course, especially in the Chickaloon area, Chief Gary and their team said, please stay out of the Moose Creek watershed. If you've driven past up there outside of Sutton, it's an extremely pretty area and it's very valuable to them. Those are some of the stipulations that that we can make and say, we're not going to look there. So the sites that that we selected for initial investigation, four sites. Out of that 158, knocked it down to a short list and got just to these four. We are looking at three storage projects, one run-of-river project. So you can see the little icons indicate a dam. That's the storage-type project, and, of course, a little river for the run-of-river. I'm just real very roughly, in case I'm just not wanting to talk over anybody, the storage projects involve the impoundment of water. It's a dam. It's going to hold water back, and it's dispatchable, which means we can control the output. Run-of-river. You still have a dam, you have a penstock, a pipe that delivers water down to a turbine, and that's the way you make water as the river flows. But there's still a dam because you have to pull it up, direct that water into that pipe and into the turbine. So that's going to come up a little bit when I talk about the specifics of the projects, because that is going to be good for some people and not good for some people. Boulder Creek. Caribou Creek, these are the ones in the north. Those are along the Glen Highway. Those are the non-FERC permitted, or non-FERC jurisdictional, I should say, projects, or at least that's what we expect. We're following a FERC process to say, yes, they stipulate that it's not FERC regulated. The ones in the south at Canyon and Godwin, we do expect those to be FERC regulated, mostly because they're on federal property. So that's a clear indication.
Yes, ma'am. What are the parameters for FERC regulation for the site permitting? Is it capacity, water diversion? And you cited federal land, but what are the other things that would tip that into?
That's a really good question. I would have to reach out to my consultants to get a full list, because there are a bunch of nuances past that where they talk about, for instance, navigable waters. That to me is a term of art. I really don't understand it. And I don't think it's well understood by a lot of folks, honestly. When we talk about what is a navigable water, or what feeds, for instance, a stream that is a navigable water, or what feeds a stream that affects fish, there's all these different criteria. The most clear indication is that, yes, it's got a touch on federal property. So whenever we do the rough cut, that's the first stop. The reason why we, on the ones that we believe are not FERC regulated, we have to do what we call a determination of interest from FERC that says, we think these are not FERC regulated. Do you also agree? So, and that way we get a piece of paper back that says, we agree this is not FERC regulated. And then we follow the state process as opposed to the FERC licensing process.
So it's not the size of project, but potential impacts.
That's correct.
Okay.
That's correct.
Representative Kopp?
Yeah. Thank you, Dustin. In the selection of these sites, was there any collaboration with the utilities in whose service areas these are? Like I'm looking at Godwin Creek, that's Seward, maybe Canyon Creek too. I'm not sure if HEA is part of that. Service area for Mat-Su Electric would be Boulder Creek. Copper Valley would be up at Caribou Creek. These are in their utility service areas. So just wondering, was there any coordination with them and this in these process?
I believe the proper protocol is through the chair, Dustin Hires to Representative Kopp. What I'd like to point out is this is an extremely long process, and we're at the very, very beginning of it. The entities that we reached out to at the very beginning are the state and federal governments, and also tribal organizations, which are sovereign, you know, tribal organizations. So they have a lot to do with an initial approach on, you know, approaching a license or a permit with the state. So those were the key stakeholders that we identified initially. And now that we've put in this first preliminary permit and the initial water rights permit, now we open up a whole period of feasibility study during which we decide who is impacted, what their level of interest is, what their level of impact is, and what that might look like as far as a relationship downstream. One of the things we don't want to do is go into a development of a site and do a lot of upfront work trying to figure out what the relationships look like on a site that is not feasible. We are in a feasibility study period, and over the course of 2026, as we get closer to that decision that it is more feasible, that conversation with the utilities that are in those areas are going to become much more important, because obviously we have relationships as far as NEA's transmission lines up the Glen Highway area. There's ownership of property in the city of Seward area. So it's clear that we'll be talking with them and negotiating with them and figuring out what that relationship looks like over the next year. Arthur, do you have anything to add?
Through the co-chair, yes, Representative Kopp, really a good question. We have, I personally reached out both to Seward Electric System and Mat-Su Electric Association to let them know that these applications were submitted, but that we stand ready and open to work together on these.
Fantastic, through the chair. Yeah, I appreciate hearing that. I'm just thinking about the Rail Belt Reliability Council and all the integrated, you know, resource plan and how this all plays into that. So it's good hearing that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we appreciate you coming and sharing with us so early in the process. Do you have a follow-up on that? Because I've got a question from Rep. Holland.
Yes, through the chair. I think that if you go back and look at the legislation that was adopted in establishment of the RTO, you're going to see a lot more generation that's going to be placed along the entire rail belt that really agnostic from transmission, because that really is what that legislation does. And when the RTO does get fully established, and that's still being going through on the regulatory side, but that's going to allow generation to be located anywhere on the rail belt without disturbance, if you will, from pricing disturbances, if you will, from transmission. And that allows, you know, through that legislation and that work that's being undertaken, will allow generation to be located at the most optimal location it can from a cost and reliability perspective, irregardless of the transmission line. So a very positive structure for the entire rail belt.
Thank you. Coach Holland?
Yeah, thank you. We just covered my question. Thank you.
Representative Costello.
Thank you, and thank you for being here. So when these projects come online, what is the impact to the ratepayer, and how do you plan for that impact?
Ruth, the representative, mayor's co-chair, but in general, any generation project that's put online has a high upfront cost, and hydro project is no exception to that. In fact, when Bradley Lake was put online in 1991, it was, and that was put online at a time when natural gas prices were 18, 20 cents an MCF, certainly on the Chugach system. That had to overcome that hurdle, but I think you have to look at it from a longer term perspective on these projects. And that's what we're seeing, the benefits of the hydro today on our system. They've been in place for a long time. I think we could also look at it from the context of maybe different pricing type structures to try to spread, you know, the cost differently. That has been done in the past. But there will be, there's no question when you put in new generation, there is a higher upfront cost associated with that. And through time, that will get cheaper in real terms as time progresses. And, I would also say we have not yet finalized numbers at this juncture to really give any specific quantification on rate impacts. We're really, really in the first stages on this effort.
Thank you. And as we're talking about the life cycle of projects, that matters too. So the hydro projects have got pretty much the longest lifespan of anything we've got going on there in Alaska, right?
Yes, that's
correct. Let's just
wait
for the geothermal and then I think that we'll see some very, very long-term projects there as well. So that's one of the tricks, I think, with electricity generation is that there's differential initial cost, capital costs to projects, and the cost of fuel and the cost of operations also varies over time. So the longer length that you look at projects really makes a difference rather than just the initial capital cost. All right. So thank you. Please proceed with your presentation.
Absolutely. Once again, Dustin Hires through the chair, just continuing the presentation. Something to look at on these four sites. They're roughly in the range of about 50 megawatt total capacity. They're in the range of 150,000 megawatt hours per year. So that that gives us a little bit of an understanding, let's say, in the comparison of our total generation for Chugach, for instance, of about 2,100 megawatt, 1,000 megawatt hours per year. This is pretty small. I want to also make sure that it's clear that when we pursue these things, that it is part of a much larger picture. That illustration that you saw of all the different things that we've got going on. This is an, all of the above approach where hydro is one component. We are pursuing these four projects not because they are the silver bullet that will get everything done. They're a major part of it that will open doors in order to provide for more development, more cooperation, more projects downstream from this. One of the biggest issues in dealing with the agencies, state and federal agencies, is that they have limited capacity. So the doged concept, that verb that came out of recent events, their offices have been cut. They cannot handle 10, 20 permit applications. So part of what they asked us to do was make sure that they didn't get hit with a huge number of permit applications that would just absolutely choke them off and be able to not move forward on these smaller number of projects. So little side note there, but I thought it was important at that time.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, excuse me. So you said in the beginning, well, first of all, good to see all of you. You said in the beginning that you did, many of the hydro potential spots in the state have been studied multiple times, I guess. And so you picked these four because of either, I guess, size and possibility and opportunity and for a variety of reasons. I guess what I'm trying to get to is what would cause these four now to get set aside and then go off to another four somewhere? I mean, what makes these durable?
Through the chair, Dustin Hires, to answer Representative Johnson's question. These four came out of the screening process, and that screening process was designed to present a portfolio that we actually thought was viable, that we could bite off, that we could chew, that we actually can get done. These things are in our region. They're relatively modest size. A lot of the larger projects, I think, without naming the larger projects, we all know that that is very problematic when it comes to fish habitat, a lot of pushback on how to execute at a very, very large scale. I think we all understand that that larger projects have economies of scale that should not be ignored. and our consultants, our consulting team at McMillan always reminds us of that, saying you're overlooking some of the bigger projects that could really drive down costs. And then we also say, but we're trying to move these four projects forward in this fashion in the FERC process in order to get to beginning of construction by the end of 2033. That's an extremely important date because that's the cutoff for ITC for these projects. So we had to pick something that we thought could actually get done within this time frame and get to beginning of construction.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. Well, I appreciate your pragmatic approach. I mean, that's what it sounds like. I've been, you know, if you've been in Alaska long enough, you've been through all the exciting projects and then they never get done or whatever. So appreciate you picking something and that the scale is such that it looks like it has real possibilities.
Thank you.
I have a question.
Representative Costello.
Thank you. And you did bring it up, the ITC. Could you let us know what that means? What I noticed is that the budget had a wide range on all of these projects with the no ITC being higher. Could you explain to the committee the significance of that?
Through the chair, Dustin Hires, to answer Representative Costello's question. Yes, I appreciate you bringing that out. I didn't catch that. What we meant to say was without ITC, not to represent that the larger number was, for instance, tied to ITC in some way. To define ITC, it is the investment tax credit. So it came out of the federal legislation. It's what allows us under Section 48 to achieve 30, 40, 50% of cost or tax credits back to us. And the reason we, the utilities, are able to participate in that was also through that legislation that allows the utilities to put in essentially a tax return and get a check back as a quote-unquote tax refund. So that's the mechanism by which the utilities can now participate along with all of the other utility companies who are for-profit and have a different type of structure. So it's very important for us to watch that legislation, watch what those timeline cutoffs are, because if we achieve a beginning of construction before the magic date, which is the end of 2033 for hydro projects, they're different for solar and wind and things like that. But for these hydro projects and actually energy storage projects, at the end of 2033, it starts to sunset. It knocks down by 25%. And another 25%, and we start losing the benefit of that legislation. So I hope that has answered your question.
Follow up. Thank you for that. So do you have to apply for that tax credit, and at what point do you know whether or not you get that tax credit?
Through the chair, Dustin Hires to Representative Costello. Excellent question. That is exactly the worry that we have and why we at UGACH, both on other programs that we've chased as far as solar projects and so on, we represent to our board and we're representing to the committee that we can't make a commitment or a representation that we're going to get that tax credit. You have to jump a lot of hurdles with domestic content, with your beginning of construction requirements. You have to do prevailing wage with apprenticeship requirements. There's a lot of things that go into that, and you can't even apply to it until after the project has been closed. So once you know all your costs, then you can report it to the IRS through the tax process. And then the IRS says whether or not we met all of the requirements, and then we get a tax refund the following year. So when we make a representation, it's without ITC so that we can say, we're not telling you that this is really cost effective and everything's going to work out fine, because we can't do that at this time. We have to go through a lot of process and make sure that there's no gotchas in there that will keep us out of the money.
Thank you. Please proceed through your presentation.
All right. Dustin Hires through the chair, continuing with the presentation. What I have is several slides here that just talk about the individual projects themselves. I know we have about 15 minutes left, so I'm going to try to run through these at some pace, but absolutely stop me if you have any questions.
It's a rough timeline. We have committee until 3.
Oh, thank you.
We've got another thing on the agenda, but it's not a hard stop.
Okay, so what I'm... What I'd like to point out about all of this information that I'm about to show you is that this is the information we have, and I'm making sure that that's clear, because it's not like we've done these massive studies. That's what the following year is for. Opening up a preliminary permit is really just opening a door to communication, a door to talk to all the stakeholders, a door to talk to NGOs and everyone else who feels like they would like to talk. For instance, with Canyon Creek, I got a call within 2 days from a miner who has claims on Canyon Creek. I mean, this is the type of interaction we're inviting. I told that miner after an hour conversation to give my number to everybody else he knows, because we want to have these conversations. Because, for instance, one of the things we learned out of that conversation was, did you know on Canyon Creek that there's a massive amount of gravel and ice that flow through that and just scour that entire basin? No, we didn't know that. What we do on our side with the McMillan team to do our due diligence is the philosophy here is fail fast. If we find these things out, whether it's through a community member telling us about their experience with that, if it's about whether we do geotech and find out that it's just not suitable to put a dam in, for instance, or a penstock, a big 60-inch pipe, we want to stop that and move to one of the other projects on our list and start that process over again, because we still need to move forward with achieving our decarbonization goals. So these 4 are not the only 4. We're not committed to them. This is a feasibility study. And once we get through feasibility, then we'll bring it to our board. And only at that time will we decide, as the board decides, that it is actually an approved project that we want to move forward with. And at that time, that's when we begin, for instance, the actual FERC licensing process. Canyon Creek, 6 megawatts, 14,000 megawatt hours per year, relatively small. It's if you, just for a frame of reference, if you're heading down onto the Kenai Peninsula and you get to the Hope cutoff or the Hope turn, keep going down a little bit. There's that, if you remember the old highway, you can still see it down there, the really sharp turn down there. That's Canyon Creek. So in the location of the facility would be further upstream from there. So give you a frame of reference for what we're talking about. It's on Forest Service land, so it clearly makes it a FERC-regulated project. So we're not going to challenge that at all. What we're looking at is a little rock dam that dams up the water upstream. It would, for instance, cover up this gentleman's mining claim, which is why he was calling. But then again, he says, I'm not against that. He says, what's your timeline? We want to work together. I said, you know, we want to do beginning of construction 2033. And he says, I might be able to work with that. And so might some of the other miners, because they can prioritize the claims that might be put underwater. On the other hand, there's the miners downstream, where you have a dam and there's a pipe that takes it down to a lower part, which is going to uncover all their claims, which is a benefit. So there's a lot of give and take in all of this, and I think we'll be making those decisions along the way, and that is part of the feasibility discussion. So.
Coacher Holland.
Actually, let me wait until we get after the next project, and I've got a couple questions. Thanks.
Okay, please proceed.
Through the chair, Dustin Hires, continuing with the presentation. Again, these things that you see on the screen, they're just the characteristics, the attributes of that specific thing. A Kaplan turbine, it's almost like a prop, like an airplane propeller. Water flows past it turns and makes power. So you've got all this information up here. I did a rough and dirty calculation this morning just to give you a frame of reference. The Capitol building here, all the way to the top, if you filled it full of water, that's about 50 acre feet. You're talking about 8,000, and that's a small project. Just to give you an idea of what we're talking about these projects, they're not small. They have impact, and that's why a lot of stakeholder concern is out there, and why we have to do so much stakeholder engagement over the next year, which, by the way, the next round of stakeholder engagements that we had before the first permission applications were put in. Those are being scheduled for April, and we're making a list of everybody else that we should be talking to. Canyon Creek, gave you the lay of the land up here. I hope on your screens or in your materials, you can kind of take some time and take a look at this. You can see the impoundment area, the blue down there, and there's a pipe that runs down and it just delivers it to that little turbine. Godwin, 16 megawatts. This is a storage type project that we're proposing. 45,000 megawatt hours per year. That's on the order of what, for instance, Fire Island Wind produces, to give you a frame of reference. Godwin is all over on the other side of Resurrection Bay from Seward. This is the project where said, of course, we recognize that there's federal land, state land involved, city land involved. There's a transmission line we have to tie into. So there's a lot of talk that has to happen over the next year. That configuration involves two dams, actually, because the basin that was cleared out as a result of the receding glacier, which, by the way, is the only reason this project exists. Brian Carey at AEA pointed out very early on when we first started getting into this project around 2014, it was really about run-of-river configurations coming in from 4th of July Creek and Godwin and trying to make something work. That wasn't very cost-effective, so we didn't get into that, but when we got into and realized, and he reported to us, the actual basin up at Godwin had cleared out and made it into a candidate for a dam. So that made it a lot more interesting because we went from on the order of 3 to 6 megawatts up to 16 megawatts. So that becomes a lot more effective, a lot more interesting to us. So two dams. There's out of that basin, there's two streams, so we'd have to dam up one of the streams and dam up the other side in order to get that water down to the penstock and make it work. 60-inch penstock, again, a penstock is just a big pipe, so 60 inches is a pretty big pipe. But we're talking about a Pelton turbine. For your reference, if you know anything about Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project, that's a Pelton-style turbine, so high head, high flow. Type of, and when I say head, sorry, speaking of engineering, a lot of pressure, a lot of flow. It makes it appropriate for that type of turbine selection. And then, of course, you have a 115 kV line that runs down there and 26,000 acre feet of storage. So start understanding the relative sizes of these things. And this is just a map of that area. If you know the Seward area at all, of course, there's the prison on the other side. If you drive up past the prison, you can stop and you can hike up Godwin Creek or 4th of July Creek and see this entire watershed area.
Coacher Holland.
Great. Thanks. Through the chair, a couple questions I wanted to touch on now that we've seen the first two projects down here. First off, I'm curious because, we've been considering some other legislation that was looking at early project development cost recovery. So it's been a topic we've been learning about and trying to understand the implications of that. I'm curious, what you've outlined here suggests a fairly significant investment that has been made already and a continued investment that you're planning on making to advance these projects. How is that being funded in terms of your co-op so you don't have investor pockets to come in and pay for this? I'm just curious, how is this investment being captured and potentially has it been turned into a regulatory asset for future recovery? I'm just kind of curious about the structure of this fairly significant amount of work that you're sharing with us today.
Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Arthur Miller, through the co-chair, Mayors. Representative Holland, a really good question. So first of all, in general, on some of what you're really asking is, do utilities get recovery of costs during construction period? That is, can we recover in electric rates construction work in progress? I think that's the legislation that is being advocated. In general, utilities can go to regulatory agencies to ask for pre-recovery before an asset is used and useful and in service. in the electric utility industry in general that has been done with large nuclear projects where the cost outlay has been in the billions of dollars, where that kind of a financial outlay would impede the financial standing of the utility. And those projects have been allowed to get recovery. And they're also multi-year projects that may take 5 or 10 years to construct. In this situation, if we ran into a situation where we needed to get recovery of these costs, we would submit a request to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska explaining our situation, that we need to get recovery while this project is being built. We do have established a deferred work order for this, each of these projects, where the cost associated with each one is being tracked. And in general, the funding on this would be done through our commercial paper program until we would convert that to we would issue bonds down the road, depending on the overall cost of the project and how many projects were done and the timing of those projects. But that really is how it would be done. Would we go in and ask for pre-approval on these projects from a cost recovery perspective? I think yes. I think that on two of these projects do fall under the RRC, where the capacity is greater than 15 megawatts. We would go through. In fact, we did submit just yesterday our application to have these two of these projects included in the integrated resource plan. But so I hope that answers your question.
It's a good start. Thank you for that. The next thing I wanted to ask, and this is kind of a broader question, but we'll do it in the context of these two to begin with. I'm assuming that there's some analysis of the capacity of the grid to be able to absorb these new power production plants, whether it's the upgrades that you're in the middle of for the transmission line out to the East Turnagain Arm area, or I presume also you're looking at the Cook Inlet crossing and the link project across there. I'm curious, how do these projects factor into your assessment of the capacity of the grid and your anticipation of what capacity you'll have in the future? Does this fit within that, or does this create some additional produce power and a challenge for trying to balance that?
Dustin Hires, through the chair, to Representative Holland's question. The planning process for the utilities is pretty complex, but also fairly straightforward. When we approach these things, we're looking at capacity expansion modeling and then a set of system impact studies. All of that has to be considered in order to figure out if we're actually going to move forward with a project. At any time, if we go down these paths and say on capacity expansion modeling or the system studies that have to happen, that we cannot physically integrate the project, either by interconnection costs, if there's technical issues with geotechnical, if there's on the electrical side, if it is creating a situation on the grid in that specific area that makes it a problem electrically, like it will make that area, for instance, unstable. These things are studied ad infinitum. Ad nausea, these we absolutely will not put something on the grid that will disturb an area and reduce reliability. I'll go back to what the CEO Arthur Miller said: no impact, no negative material impact on rates or reliability. We can't put something in that's going to disturb the grid or cause problems. That said, these types of projects represent what we call synchronous generation. That type of generation stabilizes the grid. That's an inherent characteristic of it. That's the way it works, as opposed to IBRs, inverter-based resources, which is wind and solar and things like that, where it's highly variable and comes with its own set of challenges that could destabilize the grid. This hydro generation is a good thing for the grid from a stability standpoint, but that's not a blanket checkmark. We have to go through and make sure that we can handle the load or the extra generation and that it's in the right spot electrically so that it will not disturb the grid or create a condition further downstream. For instance, the two projects on the northern Kenai Peninsula, obviously we're looking at the transmission line coming up from Bradley Lake. if for some reason we couldn't get our allocations off of Bradley Lake through that line because these cause a problem, that is going to get flagged as part of these studies. That is what we're talking about over the next year. That is one of the things that we need to answer, at least at a high level, to make sure that we're not making a poor recommendation to our board to move forward with a project. Again, fail fast. We do not want to chase projects that are going to not work. This is a waste of time, a waste of money. It is not achieving the goal, and it's not getting my job done.
Great. And last follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Thank you for that. So to put this all together then, in terms of this power coming out of these facilities onto the transmission lines, presumably also the Cook Inlet crossing, and you've mentioned grid stability and the benefits that this brings, which I understand is also part of the Cook Inlet crossing project. How does this factor into what's going on right now to create some open access tariffs? And do those tariffs, are they a precondition? And do you expect those to apply to the Cook Inlet crossing as well as your own lines that go around Turnagain Arm in terms of the modeling you're doing and the costs that'll be there?
Through the co-chair, Arthur Miller. So that will be part of the evaluation process. Are these, I think that what you're asking, are these part of the backbone transmission system? I think that is to be determined and evaluated by the any degree of integration test. There's tests that we go through to determine, are these assets part of the backbone transmission system? And that's going to have to be looked at as part of the overall process.
Okay, good enough for now. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Representative Costello.
Thank you. When you say that you have the approval of your board to move forward, is that to a next like gate or a next point in the future where then you have to go back to the board and get further approval? And if so, could you let us know what those major time periods are?
Through the chair, Dustin Hires, to answer Representative Costello's question. At this time, we do not have our board's approval. We have the board's authorization and understanding that we've chosen a small number of projects that we would like to fund and investigate in order to figure out if we can bring them to the board toward the end of the year. So during this 2026 period, we're going to move from this basic information that we're presenting to you today and get it to a point where we've de-risked the project to a point where we think we can actually move forward with it. That means that the price range that you see on the page will start to shrink. So that range will start to come into something that we believe we can actually present with it and pass the red face test that says this is a good project. We understand more for instance, geotechnical information, the water information as far as what's available from the resource, how much water there is. All of that information goes into this decision and this presentation to the board, which at that time, at the end of the year or maybe in the beginning of next year, to approach our board and say, now we're telling you that we've done our homework. We've got all the information, at least the high-level information, that demonstrates that we believe this is a good project to pursue. We will have talked to all the stakeholders. We will have talked about what the financing looks like. I think there was a question about financing and how we handle that and what that's going to be. You're right. This is a huge cost. So even on the short end, I think the total was somewhere in the neighborhood of $300 million, and on the top end, close to $1 billion. These are big numbers. Of course, we're going to have to bring to the board something that is viable, which means if we get downstream of this and we're starting to figure out, well, we like the project, but we can't do it by ourselves, we have a couple of options. There are partnership options out there. There are IPP options out there. So there are levers to pull in order to figure out how to move forward with the project. Of course, that's going to change the economic analysis, and of course, we're going to have to get comfortable and make sure that that's the right thing that we'd like to pursue. Because we are now in this RRC IRP process, we go through that process. We've submitted the ones that look good to them. The RCA still has to approve it. They still have siting authority. So all of these things, all these boxes have to be checked. Our board and the license process and the RRC and the RCA, and for that matter, the RTO, sorry for all of the three-letter designations here, but all of these checkboxes have to be checked in order to move forward. It's not just a matter of saying that we, our team, is moving forward and investigating this, just like we do any other project, by the way. We have a period of time where we investigate the feasibility before we bring it to the board. This is the same process. It's just, in this case, there's a lot more to it with a lot bigger implication across the rail belt.
So the next time you go to the board will be with one project.
Thanks. Through the chair, Dustin Hires, it could be the collection of the four projects as a portfolio.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got two more projects to get to. And I just want to say this is one of my favorite stages of a project where you've got enough information that you can see it, but you don't have to haven't worked through all the reality yet. Of course, prior to commissioning. And that's really exciting. So next on the Caribou Creek, please proceed.
Dustin Hires, through the chair, continuing the presentation. Caribou Creek, this is actually the biggest one on the list. This is one of the state permitted processes. Again, seeking agreement with FERC to say that it's not a federally regulated area or type of project, which is not a given, by the way. They have to go through a process, and their attorneys, we have met with them. They're asking questions to make sure that we've got all of our ducks in a row. 18 megawatts, we're talking about 58,000 megawatt hours per year. State, there's part of it that would spill onto Siri land. And, of course, this is one of the reasons why we talk to Siri. the features, it's a large dam, 84-inch penstock, these two 8.8-megawatt Francis-type turbines. I'm also giving you a frame of reference, the Francis-type turbine. It's basically like a wheel that spins. It sits vertically. It's the kind of turbine that's installed at Cooper Lake, for instance. So large impoundment, large number of acre-feet to get behind that. One of the other gentlemen that I spoke to from Glacier View, I spent some time with him. He was talking about some of the concerns. By the way, all the conversations we've had, they've not been negative. We've had people calling in who are concerned about the development. They have questions or issues that that they want to bring forward, but they've been generally supportive. And they want us to know what some of these problems are before we go down these roads and you know, make a bad decision. So we're trying to pull that in. We got in touch through him, through a local geologist who was telling us, for instance, did you know that the permafrost is melting? Yes, we did, but what are the implications? It's increased sloughing in the Caribou Creek area. So that sloughing has created an impact currently. It's sloughed into the river and it's redirected it. So these are the things that people are making us aware of. It's all part of the feasibility studies. Again, just illustrating for you this type of relationship that we're trying to build with everyone in order to get the information out so that we can make sure that we're doing good things here. The also miners downstream, you know, having conversations with them. The team has already talked to especially one of the miners that's that would be downstream of the dam. So a lot of engagement there. And if you don't know where Caribou Creek is, I know that the words and the creek names all kind of get fuzzy, and sometimes I mix them up too. Caribou Creek is the one that, if you're heading up toward Glacier View, you go up the Glen Highway. There was over the last, was it 10 years? There was a lot of construction. It was a really high grade going down to the creek and a really high grade going up, and you get stuck behind an RV for a while if you ever made that run. That's the creek that we're talking about, and the dam would be up away from the highway back up into the canyon.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, I think you might know where Caribou Creek is.
I do happen to know where Caribou Creek is. I guess I wanted to, this is in our area though, MEA, it must be MEA, right? Service area, is that right?
Through the chair, Dustin Hires, it's in the MEA service territory. I think it's important, and maybe it's not a nuance that comes out very readily. When we talk about generation, generation location. I'll tell you a story from back when we were building the South Central Power Project. South Central Power Project was nominated for various locations all up and down even the Parks Highway. So you're looking at locations for generation. The implication is wherever you put it, you're going to have to go across somebody else's transmission line, which means you have to pay them for that. The RTO and the OAT are addressing that situation, not necessarily where a renewable resource is going to be located and how it gets onto the grid and who gets to develop it. So we're talking about just like wind, just like solar, especially hydro, you have to go where that resource is and then tie it in through the grid. And that's part of this RTO OAT process. I think I'll turn it over to Arthur maybe to explain or give a little bit higher context on what the RTO is up to. I think you already touched on it, but I want to make sure that that it's clear what that relationship is between a service territory and the development of generation.
Through the co-chair, Arthur Miller. So just to expand on a little bit, I mean, we can even look at Bradley Lake Hydroelectric Project. That's located really adjacent to Homer Electric Association. I think they may even have some retail loads from that. But the RTO, what that does is it allows that generation to be really new generation, be located anywhere on the rail belt. Can be owned by utilities. It can be owned by IPPs. Yeah, but it really allows for the most efficient generation to be put online, agnostic to the transmission system. We've had other examples. Homer Electric has looked at Grant Lake Hydroelectric Project. That was outside of their certificated service area in other locations. So the structure of the industry is changing, and I think for the better. It's opening up the doors for the utilization of more efficient generation and the location of generation to be put on the rail belt. I think that's going to result in ultimately consumer benefit, and that's how we are approaching this.
Thank you, Representative Johnson.
So I was just looking at your map, and I guess you may be getting to this, but it looks like you'll build a transmission line up. That I see the little orange dots on their proposed interconnection. How big is the transmission line going south or out of there? Is it big enough to take additional load?
Through the chair, Dustin Hires, to answer Representative Johnson. The answer is we don't know. Okay. We believe that's a 35 kV sub transmission, what we would call in that range. It can likely handle this type of project. But we don't know that for sure. What we do know is that if you put something on that type of line, it could help with voltage stability. It could integrate, for instance, with a known solar project that the Chickaloon tribe is attempting to put up there. And we did talk to them about that to say if we put a hydro right next to a solar and it helps stabilize each other and stabilize that system going down, these are the things we're going to have to ask and answer over the next year with MEA's help because it's their line. So we do have to engage. We do have to have that conversation, and we do have to figure out what that looks like as far as an execution strategy.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Co-Chair Holland.
Yeah, thank you. Through the co-chair, two questions. One, just while we're at the map here, when I was learning more about the Wantana project, one of the things I learned about was the interruption of some caribou migration patterns. And because we're talking about Caribou Creek, it just comes to mind here. I'm curious, is that a factor? You mentioned the Androgynous Stream issue and some other environmental factors. Has any of the caribou migration in the Caribou Creek area been studied to know whether or not this reservoir will interrupt with normal migration patterns that was a problem with the other project?
So I'll say through the co-chair, I've probably been saying it incorrectly, Dustin Hires to answer Representative Holland. At this time, we have not talked about those sorts of things. I can tell you that, I'm saying that specifically, the approach that we'll have to take is twofold. One is taking a look at it from a feasibility standpoint. The other is the permitting process. And that's the state permitting process. State Fish and Game is going to require all of the same types of studies that we would do for a FERC-licensed project. Okay. And that is the type of thing that they're concerned about and would ask us to answer before they would sign off on their part of the multi-permit process that we'd have to go through in order to finally get the water rights for that that area.
Great, thanks. So through the co-chair then, I wanted to go back to, we've been talking a little bit about the backbone transmission system came up, and then we started talking about new generation now can be located essentially anywhere on that backbone that we're creating. But we also started talking about the OAT and the new rate tariffs. So I'm curious, are new additions to the transmission system going to be subject to the rate tariff and the OAT that's being developed at this point, or will things like the SIPLink be somehow treated differently?
Arthur Miller, through the co-chair, Representative Holland, really good question. Those, you know, any new projects that come online are going to have to be evaluated and to see if they are part of the backbone transmission system. I think if you, in general, if you're looking at a radial transmission line to a source of generation, there's certain criteria that are reviewed and looked at, and to make that determination, is it part of the backbone transmission system? So it really is on a case-by-case basis. I think it'd be inappropriate for me to speculate and say, yep, I think this is or this isn't. It has to go through the regulatory process and the RTO process for that determination. I think I'll leave it at that point. But I think that will have to be evaluated and addressed as part of the RTO. What's included in the RTO revenue requirement, if you will, for transmission? I think that's the ultimate question that you're asking for.
Thank you for that. I'm just kind of processing that quickly, trying to understand how the scoping of the RTO, but I admit I haven't studied the RTO close enough. It would seem like some major infrastructure additions, like it could be the SIPLink, could be a second extension up to Healy or whatnot, would be part of the RTO OAT process, but it sounds like you're saying that maybe it's not. And so I'm just trying to get a little clearer on it. I know I'm kind of going a little bit of field, but we got into the backbone and then the ability to generate any place. So I'm just trying to put the pieces together.
Representative Holland, Arthur Miller, through the co-chair. Well, I will step out. I think that absolutely the undersea cable from Beluga to Nikiski or Soldotna would be included as part of the backbone transmission system. I will subject that to RTO and commission approval. That's Arthur Miller's perspective. Also, a separate line going from Beluga to Healy would also be included as part of the backbone transmission system. If we're talking about an individual project, a generation project that's interconnecting with a transmission system, I think it'd be premature to speculate on that without going through the review process.
Perfect. Through the co-chair, thank you for that clarification. That makes a little more sense now. Thank you for bringing me back down to earth.
And before I get to a question from Representative Johnson, I think this is just illustrates there are a lot of moving pieces going on now. We're looking at, you know, what is our future of energy supply, as well as how are we going to manage it, and even how do we define it. So these regular updates, even if it's about a very specific thing, are very helpful to keep us informed as we go along. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I had a question based on past attempts to bring the utilities together into kind of one entity. And obviously that is difficult to do, since people have different assets. I mean, different entities have different assets and so on and so forth. Of course, Chugach is the biggest. I was just thinking going forward, if we want to not have discrete components, obviously we still do, but is there a way to have all the utilities as part of these projects? So, you know, so we do have some kind of something where we're not just making our problem bigger as far as in the future trying to integrate the utilities or integrate our power grid somehow. And I'm thankful that Chugach is doing the work to expand and to find and put the money in and engineering to create these opportunities. But I guess I'm wondering is how we, you know, if I would really like to see our utilities, you know, somehow in the future have share their power and maybe eventually even get our full circuit all the way, our full circle done. And just wondering how we can keep it from being harder going as we go forward.
Arthur Miller, Representative Johnson, through the co-chair, really a good question. I think that is something that, you know, we looked at on, when we first identified over 150 projects, 158 projects. Some projects are more conducive to individual utility or a couple utility ownership structures, but there's also projects that really provide a more broader benefit. In fact, I did reach out to Mr. Curtis Thayer at Alaska Energy Authority and let him know that we've identified some projects that may be of more benefit to the entire rail belt type of a structure. And we agreed. He seemed very interested, and we agreed to meet on that. We have not yet met, but that is in being scheduled. So we are open to that and sharing AEA our information on these sites that we think could provide benefit for the entire rail belt.
Thank you, Representative Kopp.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Arthur. Just kind of a follow-up on Representative Johnson's question. Is there any type of agreements that can compensate one utility to another based on, you know, like you can have one utility that's very focused on affordability, a utility that's very focused on decarbonization. But if one has a base load of power source that is much cheaper, do you have any agreements now where you actually share the benefit of that cheaper power with another utility?
Arthur Miller, Representative Kopp through the co-chair. So the Chugach and Matanuska Electric Association have a power pooling agreement.
What do you call that again?
A power pooling agreement. Okay. It really is economic dispatch, okay, where we optimize the system generation based on the assets that Chugach owns and based on the generation assets that Matanuska Electric Association owns. And through that process, we're able to achieve greater efficiencies through the operation or the joint dispatch, if you will. I call it optimal dispatch from two utilities. We would love to expand economic dispatch to the broader array along the rail belt. I think that would provide benefit to all utilities on the entire rail belt structure. And that's something that we certainly support moving in that direction. I'm not sure if I really fully answered your question. You were talking about in that context, the majority of the generation under the pooling agreement that Chugach has with MEA is from Chugach's SPP power plant and Sullivan plant, two-way power plant, because that is the most efficient generation in the rail belt on a marginal cost basis. So at the margin, it's the lowest heat rate, the most efficient generation. So, of course, you would use that generation first to meet the load requirements. Chugach does rely on and use during certain maintenance periods the output from EGS, because the efficiency of EGS, that's MEA's power plant, is more efficient than, for example, generation at Beluga. So we'll use that, and then it's a mutual benefit. But the majority of the generation from under the pool is from Chugach's baseload generation SPP in Plant 2A.
Sure, and just to follow up to that, I was looking at these hydro projects, which, you know, we all wish we had Susitna Watana, you know, to lower our costs. But looking at if a similar economic dispatch would be set up so that the other service areas would also have some benefit to a lower cost. If, in fact, it was lower cost, I mean, who knows what the final cost of that would be. I'm not saying you have all that penned out yet, but that there's a benefit there. I'm not sure how you'd do that, but you mentioned, you know, your agreement you have with MEA. Obviously, these are co-located in other service territories, and there might be some benefit to all the utilities, which kind of ties into what the RRC is doing through their economic dispatch and integrated resource plan. And
go ahead. Yes, Representative Kopp, through the co-chair. That is right. I think that additional work needs to happen. I think that if you look at the RRC and the RTO, that's laying a foundation for us to get to the next level from an operational efficiency perspective. And that's going to take time. I think it's gone very, very quickly in a positive way. It took the lower 48 decades to get to where we are and where we've come in the last several years. So I think we feel very optimistic on where we have come, and there's greater opportunities for efficiencies and working together and collaborating. And I think we need to continue down that path. And really, what does that mean from a structural perspective? I think at a minimum, if we can work together and get an economic dispatch structure put in place for the benefit of everyone and along the entire route, would be a good next step.
Yeah, thank you. You know, just going through our energy committee discussions, we're acutely aware of how energy is such a statewide concern, and obviously it's easy for us to kind of think about it regionally, and it's kind of the same with you folks who keep the whole grid operating for us, and we're more and more we're sensitive to what is the whole impact to the entire system rather than from a regional utility perspective. So right. Kind of that's where the question's coming from. I appreciate your good answer to that. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to do a time check that we do have other work on our docket today. I appreciate that we've gotten into the broader conversation. It's reinforcing some other presentations and discussions we're planning on having in the committee that we're working on putting together. But for the moment, let's get through our last project and wrap this up for today.
Dustin Hires through the chair, wrapping up the presentation. quick stop on Caribou Creek, so you can see how the valley gets filled up and gets behind a dam, produces that high head, that high amount of output. Boulder Creek is right down the road. It's a little bit closer toward Palmer area as far as being on the same highway, but it's back up there. A lot of influence from the Chicoloon area. Or the Chicoloon tribe, they are looking at damming up the Boulder Creek and then tunneling through a mountain and discharging into Chicoloon River. So that is a kind of a big deal, 8.5 megawatts, concrete arch dam. That's the only one that you'll see like that, but it's modest size, but it has an impact. This is the arrangement that you can see where you put a dam up top and then tunnel through, drop out more toward the interconnection point down at the bottom of the hill. Program status. The program overall, we've been working on this. I'll just make sure it's clear. We've been working on this for over 2 years. So we've had McMillan on staff, at least under contract, trying to work through these sites down to the 158, down to what was a short list and down to these four for quite a while. They've been trying to advise us. They've been trying to make sure that we had stepped through this in the appropriate way. They're the ones, for instance, that told us how this works, where we can put in a preliminary permit application and invite everyone in to talk about the feasibility and talk about the interest and impact on these things. We have the special note Dixon diversion. Even though it's a state project, we are spending money on due diligence. We are looking over their shoulders. We are making sure that is going in the direction that we think it should go. For instance, we had some input on geotech. They had drilled a couple of spots and wanted to make sure That is one of the major line items in that project, and we wanted to make sure that they drilled more in order to de-risk that. So just an example of our input and how we're influencing that process. Environmental and regulatory, certainly we've talked about the FERC preliminary permit process. We're in ADNR water right applications as a process. The applications have been submitted. They have not been accepted yet. So we're in the very early stages of this. Stakeholder engagement, yes, a lot of stakeholder engagement up front, mostly on the agency side and the tribal side that relates to the permitting and to the licensing process. Now we've opened up that door to talk about feasibility, moving more into the commercial discussions with the other utilities. Site characterization, this is all the fun stuff where we get LIDAR, where we get to fly in and take maps of all the entire area, the geotechnical analysis that says, is it actually safe to put something big there? Stream gauging, we put in the permits for fish habitat, for land use, for the stream gauges that we didn't have already. For instance, we already had it on Godwin for going on 3 years. So we've been interested in Godwin for a while. So we already had those stream gauges underway, and we put in for the rest of them. We have those permits now. So we're going to go out and start figuring out what the water actually looks like in those reaches. I wanted to point out preliminary designs and pre-feasibility, not started. This is very early in the process, and even though it seems weird to put up a not started as a progress report, I want to make sure it's clear. We're in the very early stage. That is downstream of all this. Just a quick hit on all the logos of all the agencies and offices and tribes and tribal organizations that we discussed, all of these things with prior to the applications, noting very clearly that the utilities' interest and impact have to be assessed as a result of having put in those open initial permits. We'll be having those discussions next. Preliminary permit process. This is the FERC preliminary permit. The people in the hydro industry really don't like that name because it's not really a permit. It is a way to open a door. It is a way to begin a conversation, and that's exactly how it's intended. So the idea here is that you have a 60-day period, and I don't know if I have a – oh, I do. Okay. I want to make sure that you understand that we are in this preliminary permit period. Our notice of application has not been issued yet. In other words, FERC still has two of our permits in hand. They're still processing it. They've posted the number, but they haven't accepted it yet. When they accept it, then there's a 60-day period where people can talk about it. They can put in their comments to FERC directly. The formal comment, that's the 60-day formal comment period. And then downstream from that period through the beginning of the formal license period, even though it looks the same on the page, that is 2026. That's the year-long, most of a year-long process. So before we get to the end, and I'll bring it back to that discussion about the board and where we fit in as far as our own internal governance, formal licensing process begins if deemed appropriate by Chugach. In other words, we got to go through all this stuff, and at the very end, our board has to tell us it's okay. Yes, they do want us to actually go forward and do this stuff, which means putting in preliminary application documents and things like that for an actual FERC process. And when I say FERC process, the licensing process itself. FERC permit timeline, the big discussion here is the big red line over on the right side. That is the investment tax credit cutoff that says we have to commence construction in earnest. And by the way, clearing fields and doing things like that doesn't cut it. Mm. You actually have to begin construction and show in earnest that you're moving forward. So that ends at the end of 2033. To point out, we are pushing and moving forward with these projects because this is an aggressive timeline for FERC. So we're moving forward with the four projects and trying to push this conversation forward because we are very anxious to try to make sure that we get that initial construction in by 2033 so we can maximize that investment tax credit return that we hope for.
Thank you, Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, why not move forward with projects that are already ahead on this timeline?
through the chair, Dustin Hires to Representative Ruffridge. I think you might be referring to Grant Lake. Is that correct?
I think, Madam Chair, I think there's a couple, if I'm correct, Grant Lake, and then I think the Susitna project has a little bit of a head start on this timeline, if I'm not mistaken.
Understood. Dustin Hires through the chair. Representative Ruffridge, Susitna Watana in particular is a very big project, and one that, although we generally have shown support for in the past and even in the recent history, it's something that is one of those projects that very likely will take a lot of utility influence and a lot of utility participation in order to move forward. That's not something we would put up forward on our own small portfolio by itself. The other version of this is Grant Lake. Grant Lake is a Homer Electric project. They have put it through the entire FERC permitting process or licensing process. I'm sorry, there's a distinction there. That license was issued and it is ready to go. It is also something that we would have to pay in the millions of dollars for, and we're not prepared to assess that just yet because we haven't figured out if these four projects are better or worse. In the meantime, there's also pending legislation that allows that project to actually maintain that status, which is not yet settled. We don't know if we're going to get into that, if we're going to be able to actually take over that permit or not. So there are a couple of projects that we know have gotten a little bit further down the road, but we don't control them. And in the case of Grant Lake, we don't know that it's actually better or worse related to our costs and our risk related to the other projects that we have discussed.
Thank you. Quick follow-up.
Yeah, so sort of to Representative Kopp's question earlier, wouldn't those items be negotiable? I mean, similar to sort of the Bradley concept where people chipped in and decided what worked for them and what didn't. I mean, at the end of the day, it's about putting electrons on wires, I think. But that seems, you know, not super far in the future, but it also, you know, seems like we could move ahead with something sooner that would, you know, that seems... Yeah, construction permitting is 2034. That's not even actual constructing. So that's a long time.
Through the chair, Dustin Hires to Representative Ruffridge. You're absolutely correct. We're very aware of the situation with Grant Lake, for instance, and our own advisors on the McMillan side have been making sure that we keep that on the list. We've chosen four that we want to move forward with, and there's right just below that is Grant Lake.
Okay.
And as we move through this year and assess the feasibility of these projects, we want to see where that ranks and see if it's actually worth moving forward with as one of the preferred projects. I know we haven't talked about it. We haven't talked about it because it doesn't belong to us. Okay. So, yes, Homer is interested in working with everyone on doing something with that project. But again, it's in a little bit of legal limbo. If it doesn't, if that legislation does not pass in D.C., then they don't get to extend that permit. And that would put us under a pretty premium crunch to say, you need to move forward now, take it over, which means we'd have to pay in the millions of dollars and move forward with the project without any other consideration for any alternatives. And that's just not a safe way to go.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Hires, Mr. Miller, Ms. Baker, do you guys have a wrap up for us as we are getting ready to move on to our next thing?
I think that's it. I really want to express our appreciation for coming down and giving an update on our projects, our decarbonization initiatives. We take, you know, this effort very seriously, and we are moving forward with projects under the guidelines and the criteria that we have established. And we're excited about the opportunities that the electric power industry provides as we move forward, and also continuing working together collaboratively across the entire rail belt. And we recognize, really, we need to look at it for the benefit of a larger group. And that's how we are approaching these projects. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. We're looking forward to progress in the projects and updates in the future. And thank you for your time today. That is it for our presentation today. We've got a bill before us We have House Bill 164, the annual net metering bill from the governor. We have a committee substitute. We'll have Tim Truer, committee aide for Co-Chair Holland, walk us through. Can I have a motion to adopt this CS, Representative Holland?
Yeah, Co-Chair Mears, I move that Energy Committee adopt the committee substitute for HB 164, work order 34-GH1571/N as a working document.
I object. Could you explain the differences?
Mm-hmm. That's where we're getting. Mr. Truer.
For the record, Tim Truer, staff to Representative Holland. Thank you, Chair Mears. I recognize we're short on time, so I will go quick. But before getting into it, I just wanted to remind the committee through the chair that this is the governor's bill. So the changes to HB 164 in this committee substitute are drawn from the amendments that were presented to this committee during the last hearing of this bill. The CS makes three substantive changes to the bill, each of which we consider to be key safeguards to this program, which have been developed in conversation with the governor's legislative office. It also makes several technical and conforming changes that were suggested by Legislative Legal Services. The first change in the CS is to the effective date. That's drawing from Amendment Number 4 that was introduced by Representative Holland. The CS would move the effective date for the bill back to April 1st, 2027 to provide more buffer for the implementation of these annualized net metering rules. Currently, the date in the bill is in 2025. Second, drawing from the language of Amendment 1 offered by Chair Mears, the CS would introduce a sunset to the annualized net metering program. So after 10 years, on April 1st, 2037, the CS would have us revert to the current status quo with no new consumer generators, no new net meter systems, qualifying for that annual net metering created by this bill. However, to ensure that the systems, net meter systems that are built close to that deadline receive some of the benefits of this annual net metering rule, the provisions call for such systems to receive 7 years of access to that annual net metering rules. So if you add 7 years to 2037, that means that this rule would fully phase out, fully sunset for all consumer generators on April 1st, 2044. And you know, as suggested by the letter that was sent around by Katie Lister, the executive director of the Renewable Energy Alaska Project, the sunset would revert rules to the current status quo before we get into this realm of material cost impacts on non-net meter customers, before those accrue in any material way. Third, drawing from the language of Amendment 2 offered by Chair Mears, the CS would also introduce a provision to ensure that undue material costs are not borne by net meter customers as a result of the net meter rules in the event that the fund created by the bill is not sufficiently capitalized. This is accomplished by creating a path for utilities to establish new tariffs for consumer generators for net meterers. Should the utilities be in a position of having to raise the rates on non-net meter customers by more than 2% as a result of net metering? The language also stipulates that the new tariff should be done in such a way that that rise in rates for the net meterers, so the rise in rate for non-net meterers is kept to 2%. The explanation of changes from version A to N of HB 164 document that was circulated to the committee members covers section by section how these changes are accomplished. I'd be happy to answer any questions about any of these changes, but again, noting that the Holland office is not the sponsor of this bill.
So I wanted to make a couple comments on things as we move forward with this CS. One is I see this net metering program as an opportunity to encourage residents to invest in infrastructure for electricity generation. And by having an annual net metering program, that helps buffer some of those costs for people that are making that investment. I know one of the conversations, because there's a companion bill over on the Senate side, is the discussion that we'd had about subsidization of other users. And so one of the concerns about annual net metering is that the folks that are getting a benefit from the annual net metering are not paying for the infrastructure that then distributes those electrons around. There's a couple points I have on that. One is that folks are investing their own capital in electricity generation. to provide more power for everyone. But also, not everyone's costs are the same to a utility to begin with. So my neighborhood, I believe, was built with undergrounded lines in the late 60s. Our houses are relatively close together. That's going to have a very different cost than for folks whose homes are further apart that might have overhead lines. So I think my cost for net metering may very well be less than those that have got further distances apart that might need more attendance to their overhead lines. We are all on a postage stamp system, even though our costs are not equal. So I think that's a consideration as we think about that. So those are just a couple comments I had on the work of this CS.
Oh, no, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity for us to be able to bring the updated CS to the committee, and looking forward to, if there's no objections, being able to move it forward once we're done with the discussion.
Representative Johnson, and then Representative Kopp.
Yes, I have a question. Are these changes ones that were are these done in conjunction with the governor? I mean, I heard at the end you said this is, you're not the sponsor of the bill, but once you do make these changes, you will be, I guess, right? It'll be a committee bill. And so then it will be.
So Representative Johnson, we did take those amendments, and it's my understanding that was a negotiation with the governor's office, that the current CS is acceptable to their office. So yes, it is a committee bill, but it is in collaboration with the executive branch.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know. Thank you. So, let's see. I had another question on there, but I will think about it.
We can get back to you, Representative Kopp.
Yeah, I appreciate that. This keeps net metering, but it's adding guardrails. That was one of the big concerns the committee discussed. That didn't really seem to be a fiscal safety valve, and certainly there is now for rate impacts. And I think some of the open-ended liability is now definitely bounded. I do see a soft obligation to future legislatures. There certainly will be pressure to recapitalize that net metering fund. I think, I'm not sure where the bill goes from here, but
finance.
So yeah. So some things, just to put them on the record, is, you know, will this generation that consumers are generating, will it somehow require any upgrades to the fixed infrastructure that the utility is not able to recover? That's one of the challenges of a retail rate net metering. You get a retail rate reimbursement, but if you're not also being charged any fee to help maintain the grid, it's almost like the education debate, right? We all want choice and we all want good schools, but we want the fixed neighborhood schools to be strong. And are we little consumer generators would be, you know, families that homeschool their kids, but also should they be reimbursed at the same rate, a one-to-one? That's kind of the exact discussion we're having here, retail rate net metering reimbursement. Or should it be a little bit less so that you're helping maintain that power grid that the utilities have to maintain? And I couldn't help but notice the corollary with education too. It's really the same thing that we're faced with. We want them both to be successful. We're trying to get the balance right. And it may not be a bad idea to consider a sunset review, maybe by the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee in 2034, something to look at the costs, the rate impacts to ratepayers, and just, do we want to continue this? Just say, you know, just give it a date for a full review. But those are my thoughts, but I appreciate the work that went into the CS, and I definitely has a significant more guardrails than I had before.
So Representative Kopp, I hope the amendments that we put on there with the rate impact, as well as the timeline sunset on there, would impact that, because we talk about in this building a lot is, you know, like, what can you count on for the future? Mm-hmm. Certainly we're always in the situation that we're not binding a future legislature for making whatever changes to anything that they want to, but right. I think that those limitations help kind of cap that so it keeps things from getting out of control. And, you know, estimates are, you know, 2% is way more than any potential impact would be. So,
yeah, thank you.
Representative Johnson.
There isn't a fiscal note on this yet, is there? I mean, I couldn't, I don't know.
Representative Johnson, I haven't looked at this in a minute, but it would be the capitalization of a reimbursement fund would be the fiscal impact.
Well, I figured that out. That's why I was wondering what it would look like if we would have to put money into it.
I haven't looked at it in a minute. I don't recall.
So, okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess that's what I'm trying to figure out, is if there was any kind of initial outline for it.
Representative Ruffridge.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Who should I direct questions to about sort of the bill sections, a few that have changed, and then just sort of the underlying impact to ratepayers? Is that now to be directed to the committee chairs? We don't have the bill sponsor here. Is that
Representative Ruffridge? I think the co-chairs will do our best.
Okay. So first question I have, is there an estimate sort of to the question that Representative Johnson just asked, an estimate about what that fund capitalization would look like to offset? I think the language of the bill is somewhat interesting when it says, that essentially this section will now, grant an unreasonable preference or advantage to customers, That's what Section 1 is allowing under the new Section 4205.395. And so I would just like to know if there's an estimate for what that preference or advantage would be to someone that is installing a system that allows for credits.
Representative Ruffridge, my recollection is there is a limit to that, and it wouldn't be more than they're generating. Let me see if I can look up the documents. I don't seem to have it in my notebook. Representative Holland, do you recall?
No, I just was going to check to see if Mr. Truer had a recollection of any direct answer to that. I mean, I think, though, I'll just preface that with the governor's office did work with AEA to provide some capitalization for an interim cost recovery program. And my understanding is that to date, none of the utilities have applied to use any of it at this point in time. I think there's still a degree of uncertainty around what the real cost would be, the process of trying to define that cost, and then the process to apply for it. And part of what this bill does is provide some structure to be able to start figuring out what that cost would be, recognizing that it has some uncertainty with it. But I don't know, Tim, do you have any more you can offer with?
I wouldn't want to say a number on the record just because I'm not totally sure. And there's different ways of calculating those costs, whether it's revenue that the utilities don't see or some other means. But I'd be happy to follow up with Representative Ruffridge. I know third parties have put some sorts of estimates and done some sorts of calculations on that question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. My question that goes along with that, if I may,
go ahead, Mr.
I'm sorry, Representative Ruffridge.
Okay, well, I don't want to get over my skis there.
I forgot I needed to acknowledge you. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. On page 2 of the proposed CS, it has a phrase. Starts on the very bottom of page 2, line 31. Seek to recover revenue losses attributable to the entity's net metering service. Is there a proposal for how the AEA would calculate a revenue loss attributable to net metering? That seems one, not defined in the bill, and two, difficult to define.
Madam Chair.
Representative Cobb?
Yeah, on that note, it seems pretty straightforward. A utility could measure the percent of its load that is being produced by consumer generators, because they are actually doing a retail rate net metering back right now under the bill. They could probably tell you exactly 2%, 3%, 4% of the load that we have is being produced by consumer generators. It would seem to me, I mean, there's no utility company sitting here, maybe one of our smart guys in the back, but it seems like that would be a quantifiable that they could hear. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Obviously, in this scenario, there's a cost shifting that goes from the high generating seasonal time frame, right? So there's going to be a time frame in which there is a large amount of power generated. Some of that will be used for the consumer, and then a small portion of that would be used to sell back to the grid or to meter back to the grid. So if you were measuring the entire amount of production, and then that would be considered a revenue loss, then that amount might be much higher than the amount of credits that are essentially paid for or utilized in the off season. So this bill does not say how that gets used. If it's credits used in the off season is defined as a revenue loss, that's much different than total power generated being a revenue loss. Does that make sense? And this bill does not define which one of those options gets chosen.
Thank you. Through the co-chair, and Tim, maybe you can help me here because I'm looking at a different version, but I think the bill is pretty explicit to the degree that it says the commission shall adopt regulations to implement the section and establish standards and procedures for calculating the load service entity's revenue loss. So I think the question you're asking is appropriate, but it's addressed in the bill as an area of work to develop that definition. So to the degree that you're asking a question that there needs to be some development, the bill says there needs to be some development to address that question. Did I go around in a circle, or does that make sense that your question is appropriate, but the bill addresses the fact that that is a question and directs the RCA to address it?
Yeah. Well, it would be through the chair, Representative Holland, it would be the AEA, I think, not the RCA. And I, if I could paraphrase what you said.
No, I think it is RCA.
Say that again. It says the load serving entity apply to the Alaska Energy Authority to seek to recover revenue losses. But I...
So I'm looking at page 3, line 18. The commission shall adopt regulations to implement this section that at a minimum establish standards for procedures for calculating a load service entity's revenue losses eligible for recovery under this section.
So under this bill, the regulatory commission will adopt regulations to implement the section and the regulations for calculating a load serving entity's revenue loss. But then the AEA will administer that
right
for the RCA?
Yeah, Tim?
I might just point to page 4, lines 27 through 29. Subject to appropriation, the authority, meaning the Alaska Energy Authority, may make payments from the fund to a load-serving entity eligible for recoverable costs under AS 4205-395. And implement regulations adopted by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska.
Okay, yeah, that through the chair. I think that makes it very clearly vague. And I mean, maybe that's what we want, is something very vague going forward. That's typically not what I like to do. It would be nice to know that the bill we pass out of this committee would have a clear definition of what the because one of those things will attribute greater cost than the other. If it is the total amount of power generated, that is a significant amount of cost. Considering, for example, Chugach Electric, who is just here, in the year of 2022 alone had hundreds of customers installing residential solar panels. And so, you know, if that over time is adopted over the course of 7 years, you could have thousands of new customers on residential solar. And if they are offsetting that rate, and then at a rate of 2% of total power generation, if you choose total power generation, you're talking about tens of millions of dollars per utility in offset revenue. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to figure out if there is a means by which to calculate that just on some small basis. And if the answer to me is we'll figure it out later, I'm not entirely certain that that's a useful or helpful answer.
Well, Representative Rutledge, I think since we're at time, I think the we'll figure it out later still remains within this committee. I'm hoping that we can get the CS adopted today, and we will move on to the adoption of a bill on a later date.
Madam Chair.
303.
Yeah.
Representative Cobb.
I just jump in. I think a little bit of a response to Representative Rutledge, because I think he is asking an important question, but we don't have to solve it today. Ultimately, the you know, the next future committee or this committee, however it goes, I think the RCA is integrally, so my little scribble here to just in response to Representative Rutledge's concern is, the bill could say that each load-serving entity shall report quarterly the total installed consumer generator capacity as a percent of peak load. And if penetration exceeds whatever percent, the commission, the RCA, shall open a docket to evaluate rate decision and system impacts. In other words, it's not static, it's dynamic. And it's, you know, it's reevaluated based on the percent of peak load that's being produced by these consumer generators, because it's not like we can fix it in statute. It's got to be, it'll go to the RCA, and we just need to make sure it's clear to them that under these circumstances, you open a docket and you evaluate the rate design and the system impacts. And I think that gets to what Representative Rutledge is raising. And
right.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, do you maintain your objection to adopting this? Yes. My objection. Thank you. Are there any further objections to?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair. Was the plan to move this bill out of committee today?
I think we have run out of time to do that.
Yeah, that was the plan. I think
I would make a motion to move the bill out of committee. And my reasoning being that this goes next to the Finance Committee. This issue has been around a long time. Mm-hmm. It's very evolutionary, if you will. It's going to evolve. I think we can send the bill to the next committee, and whoever presents it can bring that question of light. I consideration of the question, I think it's legitimate, but we're going to lose a whole week and we don't have many weeks left this session. It is a governor's bill. I think we should move it out of committee.
Okay. So, there was no further objections to adopting the CS. The CS is adopted. You want to formalize that motion, Representative Edgman?
I move that energy committee. Let's see, where's my
top of page 6? Yeah.
Co-Chair Mears, I move House Bill 164, work order number 34-GH-15711/N as amended from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes allowing for conforming changes as necessary.
I'll object. And may I just speak to my objection briefly?
Yes, please.
Thank you. I certainly appreciate the effort to move this forward to the next committee. Unfortunately, that's a committee on which I have no input into. And so I would have liked to have some opportunity by which this committee to take a look at some of these issues. Representative Kopp, I think, provided some language that was actually much more clear and direct about what that potential for the RCA would be. I think that we could tidy that up just a bit, hopefully. If we move that out now, we'll take that into consideration later. But certainly none of us are on that next committee, so I'll leave it up to y'all to figure that out.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Can you call the roll?
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Kopp.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Rutledge.
No.
Representative Costello.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Co-Chair Holland.
Yes.
Co-Chair Mears.
Yes.
6 yeas, 1 nay.
Thank you. With a count of 6 yeas and 1 nay, this bill passes from committee. That concludes our business for today. We will not be meeting this Thursday. Seeing no further business before the committee, this meeting is adjourned at 3:07 p.m.